Welcome to the Sum of It All Street Data Podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're exploring the book Street Data, a Next Generation Model for Equity, Pedagogy, and School Transformation by Shane Safir and Jamila Duggan. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we are chatting about Chapter 1, Leading for Equity, and it's the first half of Part 1 on Why Street Data, Why Now? You know, and with all of our podcasts, but in particular with this season, I wanted to take a moment just to acknowledge that we consider ourselves to be on our own learning journeys and approaches to the top. We approach the topic, I guess, in this book with great humility. I know we have much to learn, and our conversation recorded today is really just our best thinking today. And as hard as it will be for me in a couple of months, I hope that when we look back at this in a few weeks, months, years, that we cringe at our recording because we realize we've continued to grow and understand things in a new way. So for now, we're glad that you're on the learning journey with us and offer this conversation as a way to deepen our understanding of what we're reading in this book study.
Audrey, I really appreciate how you're kicking us off today. That makes a lot of sense. And what I want to start out with is just this optimistic quote at the start of the chapter. And the quote is, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." And I think the reason I want to center with that quote to start things off in my thinking is, you know, we spent a bit of time over the last 9 seasons of this podcast really talking about how our system has been broken for many of our most vulnerable students and how we have cared for them in the learning of mathematics. So what I'm thinking about as I read that quote, as I started reading this chapter, I really want to approach this season with a continued sense of acknowledgement of the harm that's been done to our students and how we continue to fall short, but while also holding on to hope that through this text, we can identify these practical steps to dismantle the broken system that we've inherited, really just down to that classroom level. And on page 11, the authors write, "I view schools a possibility spaces in which to reimagine society." I think that also is such a good reminder to us that we really need to remember the real implications of our work with students. It's not just for what they do that school year or even in their time in a TK-12 system, that our shifts in schools really can push against the reality of our society and make real change, not just in the school space, but in the societal space. And I just think that's real power, Audrey.
It truly is. It truly is. So with that, let's kick off this discussion on Chapter 1. We're really thinking about ways to think about our conversation today and thought it might be helpful to use some of the reflection questions that are at the end of the chapter to guide our conversation today as math educators. So in light of that, I thought we might start with question 2, which says, how has the press for big data and results impacted you and your community? What have you gained and or lost? Mark, do you have thoughts about that?
I definitely have thoughts about that. Boy, that is a really powerful question. And Audrey, what a great idea to use the questions at the end to frame our discussion today. And, you know, when you read that question and I'm thinking about it, I really go straight to page 12. There's a quote right in the middle of the page from the authors. And Audrey, I'm just going to say, it's going to be so hard in this particular season not to read huge parts of this book out loud to our listeners. Hopefully you're reading along because it's really quite amazing and hard to just pick a couple things. But I'm going to just pick this one quote here that says, "The test and punish era incarcerated our collective imagination. And many schools and districts continue to seek off-the-shelf instructional programs rather than build internal capacity and entrust teachers with the art of pedagogy." And I just think that the thing that resonates with me about that quote is I think that would have been the case before the pandemic, that quote would have resonated with me, but I think it even resonates with me more, this idea of off-the-shelf programs and not entrusting teachers with the art of pedagogy. I just think those are really important ways to respond to that question that you asked.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark. That resonates with me too, and I can see that as part of our current reality and our current story of what it means to teach mathematics. You know, when I think about so many of our conversations that we have with folks in our office and in other offices who talk about other content areas, you know, science and English language arts and social studies, that sometimes what I hear is our friends say, you know, we don't have this kind of privileged seat that math has or that English language arts has, because we're not a tested content area. And so we aren't as valued as much. So if schools are going to give something up, they're going to give up the time to do science in elementary, and they're going to give up the time spent on doing arts and thinking of other things. And, you know, there's a flip side to this. And when this question talks about, like, how has that press for big data and results impacted us? Like, every time we go to have a conversation around math instruction and teaching and learning, we always get a push for what will be the impact on the test scores. And when you support a highly assessed, like a high stakes assessment area, means that so much of the focus on improvement or change is all about big data and results. You know, I even had an administrator recently ask me, you know, is there any proof that increasing student discourse in math is linked to increased test scores? And like, I couldn't even think of what to answer. Like, there's research about student discourse in math improving learning, like,
right,
test scores, like, yeah, is that really our focus? And so, like, it's such a hard space to kind of live and breathe in, this overwhelming desire or oppression almost, it feels like, on top of us to, like, improve test scores and big data and results instead of a focus on our students and a focus on learning. So this one sat heavy with me.
Yeah, for sure, Audrey. And, you know, the other thing you're making me think about is the author's inferred is it really gets into this thinking about various ways of knowing something. Because that, to your point, if these test scores may or may not be even truly accurately measuring what our students know. And Shelley Moore in her Five More Minutes videos, which are wonderful, if you want to Google those, that's Shelley Moore, Five More Minutes. She has a video, these are just these short clips, and she has one called Presume Competence. And it really connects with what we're talking about, this idea of expanding. And what she says in the video is her number one recommendation is expand the definition of what it means to know.
Yeah, I love that. That reminds me so much of Paula Tan's work back from our season 2 book about how mathematics needs our students. It's not the other way around, right? So I'm just connecting it with that, Mark.
Yeah, and there's another connection I'm making as well, is there's a video interview with Jeff Duncan Andrade. And in that particular video where he's talking about how we need to dismantle the system, you know, he talks about how we should build the curriculum for Black and Indigenous students, our most marginalized students. And in doing so, we'll build the curriculum that's good for everyone. I thought that was such a powerful part of his video, and really something to really challenge us and consider that, and what that would look like, and how that could impact our students, especially in the area of mathematics. And another quote from the book we're reading now, in chapter 1 on page 11, says, as things fall apart, I'm just going to pause for a second and say, yeah, things have definitely fallen apart. As things fall apart, maybe the answer to our deepest challenges lie not in test scores and curriculum guides, but in the cultural wealth and wisdom of our villages, both current and ancestral. And that's on page 11.
I appreciate that, Mark. You know, the connection the authors made at one point in this chapter about the work being like an ecological project, this analogy just so resonated with me around, they talk about we've overfarmed the land and undernourished our students and educators while failing to water the roots of a healthy system, which are student voice, multiple ways of knowing and learning, and community cultural wealth. Like the idea that impressing for big data in our math classrooms, classroom after classroom, lesson after lesson, we have essentially overfarmed the land. And so, yes, you're getting product or produce or something from the land, but at some point in time, you get less and less and less, right? And you are undernourishing the fertile soil, our students, right? And at some point, that land will no longer be usable for what it's intended to be. Do you see that the analogy being so true for me in terms of like, you know, I hear our teachers say, like, I'd like to make time for student voice. I'd like to have time to do tasks that allow my students to engage in those ways, but I don't think I have time. So like the big data of this is that constant over farming of our land. It's a great analogy for my understanding.
Oh yeah. Such a powerful analogy. And I'd like to add on to that, Audrey, with another part of that analogy they mentioned is that the current approaches are not bearing fruit where the tree is most barren. And I think we continue to sort of just do the same thing over and over and getting the same results. And I just think in and of it, and by us doing the same thing over and over and getting no different results, I think there's an added part of harm that happens. And what I think about this is it continues to retread that false narrative that our most vulnerable students are not capable. And Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez shares as she introduces this idea of gap gazing. And, you know, when we're looking at data, that we continue to gaze at the gap in mathematics between different student groups. And that can feed our biases about Black, Latinx, and Indigenous students. So I just think those are things for us to really grapple with as we decide if we have the will to change some of these things and where we really are stuck. And Audrey, as I mentioned that, I'm seeing that one of our next reflection questions, question four, really has to do with this idea of an achievement gap. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to ask that next question and send us into the next discussion. And the question is, question four, do you believe the achievement gap is a mythology? Why or why not?
Such a great question. And so hard to answer. I guess I see this idea that achievement is different for different student groups. Like I see, like, and yet I'm reading this chapter and seeing how nuanced it is about thinking about students as being in groups. I'm torn with how to answer this question. So I think what I might do is say, I might start with like this idea of like standardized assessments, which feed into whether or not there's an achievement gap. Are they biased or unbiased? And, you know, I used to think that standardized assessments were unbiased. I used to think that they were created in a way that was supposed to be free from bias and they were fair. And then I met someone who I consider to be truly brilliant, one of the brightest people I know, who identifies as a multilingual learner, a child of immigrants, a Latino, who took a test that I had assumed was fair and unbiased, and they were not able to pass it. And I looked at that and it really tore at my, I'm like, how could they not pass this test? Right. Oh, maybe it's a fluke, you know? And I think I explained away so many times the bias of the test as being something that happened only in that moment. And yet this person is not an anomaly, I guess, when you look at it, like there are all kinds of people who don't pass this test, with multiple tests and training and educations and understandings and abilities to do amazing things. And yet this test continues to sort. And so I just keep looking back at that and thinking, I don't know that I can say standardized assessments are unbiased anymore. I think that maybe inherently they are biased by who's writing them and by what they measure.
Yeah, the powerful points, Audrey, for sure. And, you know, it really leads me to think about some of the things on page 13 about, you know, that this attempt to infuse culturally responsive pedagogy into our content areas and perhaps our assessments in an attempt to try to make things so they are more culturally responsive. But I think the authors give this really interesting caveat to all that. And here's what they say. Despite our talk of equity and culturally responsive education, we continue to base policy and success frameworks on a data model that is narrowly Western, Eurocentric, and racist. And so it really makes me think, you know, about what you're talking about and what the authors mentioned here. And it makes me just want to consider how might a different data model be essential for some and good for all.
I like that, bringing back in that universal design for learning kind of question. You know, it makes me wonder if all assessments are biased, like even the ones I write as a teacher for my own classroom. And I think it's important to say, like, if we're not looking at the data that comes back from any assessment and looking at the results and acknowledging when the results are skewed, that then something is broken. And it's not the student that's broken,
right?
But maybe the instruction, maybe the assessment, you know, like those are hard conversations to have. And I, you know, I don't think that means we just throw out all of our assessments, but maybe it does. I don't know.
Oh, wow. That's a heavy question, Audrey. yeah, that's, wow. I'm thinking about that. You know, I think the best answer I can give to that right this moment is I'm gonna draw an analogy to another thing going on in education right now, which is grading. There's a lot of folks that are rethinking or thinking again about grading, and you know, I think when I've noticed people rethinking their grading and reading different books around that and really being thoughtful, and my children's own teachers doing that, my children are in high school. I've noticed that people didn't just say, I'm going to stop grading. I'm just not going to grade anything. And instead they've gotten really thoughtful about how to completely dismantle the grading practices they've been using to better serve their students. So I'm wondering if that analogy helps us here as we think about, big data and other types of data. It's not a push that says we're not going to assess, but we have to revolutionize it. We have to do it in a way that doesn't harm kids and it centers well-being. You know, the authors mentioned in this chapter this idea of centering well-being. I wonder how when we revolutionize assessment, we might center the well-being of our students and also our teachers. So let me take it a bit further. So if standardized test scores have been our goal, so that's our true north, because that's kind of been our true north for a while. Our way of evaluating the worth in this educational system and the worth of our individual students, we have to go back and see what are all the things that support that goal of test scores. Well, that has to do with the pacing guides we have, the test prep, all the things that support that goal. So we're backtracking from that goal of standardized test scores and it wags the whole system. So Audrey, here's what I'm wondering. What if we change that goal? What if the goal is not test scores, but as the authors imply, what if the goal is well-being? And then what if we backtrack that and see if everything leads to that goal? I wonder, what are the things that lead up to the goal of well-being and how will those push on the things that we currently have as part of our system?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mark, and a great reframing. And, you know, I think the authors have shared some of those. I think, you know, they talk about student voice and various ways of knowing. Those are circling back for me here in this question. But I also think it might push us to rethink time. I think most of our pain points when we talk about math teaching and learning often point back to there not being enough time. And so I wonder to what extent our Western views of time might need to get pushed on to think about it differently. So lots to unpack there, more than we have time to do today, but right. Those are all things I'm thinking about with this question. I think we might have time to squeeze in one last question, Mark. Maybe we circle back to question one in the end. Sure. And here's question one from the reflection. Mm-hmm. It says, starts with a quote, "For all our talk of being student-centered, we have bought into a success paradigm that robs many children of their voices, marginalizes their gifts, and prioritizes measurement and incremental improvement over learning and transformation." Question says, what are your reactions to the quote? Do you agree, disagree, something in between? What do you think?
All these questions are great, Audrey. Mm-hmm. Lots to think about. I think what I would say to that is I'm going to go all the way back to the start of this chapter. Chapter 1 is there's the header that starts the part of the chapter in the beginning is it says reclaiming the village, children at the center. And in this part of the chapter, one of the authors describes their experience and where they consider how an Indigenous culture might contrast with a Western cultural view of society. And what I think about that is that Western culture view of society, of course, in turn greatly influences our system of education and also influences our mathematics education in our country. And there's in that particular retelling, there's a phrase in there they use, and it says, the hierarchical system fosters competition and lateral violence. And Audrey, what really comes to mind with that is it really echoes for me that the work of Zaretta Hammond in culturally responsive teaching in the brain, in terms of that idea of individualist and collectivist mindsets, and even as we discussed that book before, Audrey, even in the trauma we put our most underserved students into during math class. So those are things that really come to mind with this idea of question number one.
Yeah. You know, the story at the beginning of the chapter that you're describing does such a beautiful job for me of juxtaposing what I think our current reality is and what student-centered really means or really could be. And what I guess I'm curious about is that at the end of the quote, they suggest that measurement and working towards incremental improvement is problematic, mm-hmm. and that it gets in the way of learning and transformation, right? And it wasn't until we went back for a second look or a second take on Peter Liljedahl's book, Building Thinking Classrooms, that I was so struck with his point around that small changes are the enemy of transformation. Mm-hmm. That when he talks about, like, you want to change the system, you want to change from mimicking in math to thinking in math, that asking to make small changes actually just perpetuates the same nonsense. It doesn't actually change the system. Mm. And so it's swirling in my head with this in terms of this idea of this incremental improvement. If we could just get a little bit better, it ends up, I think when you think about dismantling a system, it ends up perpetuating the system. It doesn't create enough of a wham, a moment or something that just hits you upside the head that changes things. And so, you know, I know we've talked about this before, like students who learn math for a test only to not remember it or know it a short time later, like there wasn't real learning there. And so I'm really thinking about this, Mark, like what is the space in which we move away from measurement or incremental improvement, and what's the alternative, and what could happen instead? So super interesting, or an interesting question for me. And as we're closing out on time, I'm curious what else might be circling in your head as we close out this chapter, looking forward to the next chapters that we're going to read.
Well, I'm certainly going to think about that last point you made, because I think you've made some great points around that piece around incremental change. I'm still thinking about that, actually. So I'm gonna have that in mind as I continue through the chapter. But I think the main thing that's circling for me is on page 19. It's toward the bottom. There's a really powerful quote that really is going to stick with me into our next chapter. And it says, at the heart of the book lies an existential question. Why do we rely on current forms of data? And what would happen if we simply stopped? I just that hit me when I read that. What if we just stopped and embraced a new model? And I think it goes back to our earlier discussion today, which is thinking about, is it about stopping everything altogether, or is it, but then I'm thinking about your incremental change, and that's not the way to do things. So Boy, I've got some dissonance around this, and I just am looking forward to talking about it. And again, like I talked about at the beginning of this episode, what are the practical things that we can do to dismantle?
I really appreciate it. You know, that quote did stick out to me too. I highlighted, I circled, and then I even wrote in the margin, just stopped, like question mark. The other thing that's circling with me is the mathematician in me loved this idea. It's at the very, very end of the chapter, and it's small and hidden, but they talk about this idea of fractal changes require fractal solutions. And the analogy of a fractal challenge is just so intriguing to me. And so I am super curious and wondering, what do fractal solutions look like? And I'm so excited to think more about that, because maybe there is the difference between just stopping and incremental changes. Maybe there's something completely different that we need to be thinking about instead. So excited to read more.
Wow, that's great. Well, thanks everyone for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about chapter 2, No Shortcut. Until then, send us a tweet with the hashtag SumMathChat. That's hashtag SumMathChat with your questions and thoughts. We'll keep the conversation going there. Until then, best wishes on transforming education.